bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate you. So you ever wonder how those deranged and destructive policies that are attacking our society from every angle end up from the minds of these totalitarian leftist billionaires to Joe Biden's desk? Well, we are going to look at one of the most powerful left-wing dark money networks in the world, and we're going to show just that. So I'm joined in the studio here by my colleagues. We got Gary Benoit, who's the editor-in-chief of The New American Magazine, and we have Steve Bonta, the executive senior editor. And Steve just got back from a very exciting trip, and we're going to hear about more about that later this week. So don't let him know too much, Steve, but I'm sure you'll bring it up. So anyway, going back to our top story here, you guys won't be surprised to find out that there is this dark money operation, and it's probably not the only one, but what it does is it channels mega donor funds into leftist political causes. And the way it does that is through these pop-up groups that are designed to look genuine, like genuine grassroots outfits. We're seeing something like that play out now on the campuses. We're going to discuss some of that too. So this outfit is called Arabella Advisors. And it acts as a for-profit consulting firm. It is a PR firm. Apparently, the people in D.C. call these people Beltway Bandits. So as I was looking into this, I had to actually, draw me a diagram because the way it works is so convoluted. This reminds me of one of my first investigative reports where we looked at various companies that were buying land and not doing anything to it, and they had all these shell corporations. Well, this isn't necessarily that different. So what you have is you have Arabella Advisors at the beginning here in the center, but what they do is they create all these nonprofits. They're 501c3s and 501c4s. And then it's those nonprofits, that's where the money comes in. We have lots of money coming in through those, billions of dollars, actually. I think from 2019 to 2022, these nonprofits received $5 billion from left-wing billionaires and probably some grassroots folks or whatever. But what happens then is once the nonprofits are set up, they then hire advisors from Arabella Advisors. And so it's quite clever, really. And so what happens is this network apparently has influenced almost all the electoral and policy victories the left has achieved over the last few years, and even at the federal, at the state, and the local level. Arabella has stuck its nose in battles over Supreme Court nominations. One of its groups, its front groups, is Demand Justice. If you remember, they fought Kavanaugh's nomination. It has also stuck its nose in abortion, women's sports, K-12 schools, Medicare for all, environmental policies, fake local news outlets, and Zuckbucks, of course. And they all have their specialty. For instance, the Windward Fund is devoted to environmentalism, whereas the New Venture Fund, the 1630 Fund, they're more into policies, government policies, and then the Hopewell Fund is into abortion. And so we know this in part because I'm sure there's others who know it, but there's a new book by former George W. Bush official named Scott Walter, not to be confused with former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. This is Scott Walter. And he works for the Capital Research Center, and they wrote a book called Arabella, the Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Transforming America. So, like I said, they show that these guys take in gobs of money. Now, one of his chapters shows how these nonprofits actually go, they're the center, they're the conduit for policies that what we're seeing now. So we're going to look at a 501c3 called Governing for Impact. And so this is one of the nonprofits that's devoted to government policies. And so what it does is it has high-level contacts within the Biden administration. Now, within the first two years of the Biden administration, Governing for Impact brags that the Biden administration has enacted 20, more than 20 of the group's policy recommendations. Now, their Grow for Impact's internal presentations to donors say that it has drafted more than 60 policy memos designed to shape the federal departments, and it actually has a target on all the major ones. We could look at that later. So the author of this book, Arabella, says that in this, initially what we have is we have the nonprofit dog wagging the tail of the Democratic Party. Is it the other way around? One way or another. And so essentially these folks tell the Democratic Party what to do, and it looks like in a way they tell the Biden administration what to do. Now, of course, the question is, who is behind all this? Well, it's not going to be, it's no mystery there, but we have these folks here. And so we're actually, when you look at who's funding these funds, because in a way, a lot of these nonprofits have to reveal who some of their funders are. For instance, you have the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which of course is Bill Gates. You have Silicon Valley Community Fund. And so, these are some of the research there that shows how much money, what percentage are coming from these folks. You have Silicon Valley Community Fund. And that's, again, that's Zuckerberg. You also have Chan Zuckerberg Initiative Advocacy, more Zuckerberg. So they find different ways to pour money in this. And of course, no surprise, you have Ford and Rockefeller, and you have Open Society and Tides, which of course is George Soros. It's pretty interesting though, because now a lot of the campus protests we're seeing are also coming from George Soros. And so this is no surprise. We know that the Post did a story and it showed how the New York Post, showed how George Soros is funding that. So I want to go to a piece of tape from the author, and then we're going to get into some discussion here. So here's the author of the book, Arabella, Scott Walter. And what he's doing is he's explaining how Arabella works.
Well, the thing about Arabella is pretty much any left-wing agenda item that you can come up with, they have been mixed up in. They're very big on all environmentalist craziness, but they've also been mixed up in, like, Title IX fights. That's the one, that's the Education Department regulation that forces men into your girls' sports teams. They're huge players in the abortion fights. Medicare expansion, on and on. You name it, and they do it.
Wow. What is it about leftist billionaires that are in love with tranny guys going into into girls' locker rooms? I'm serious. I mean, I have to wonder, what is it about being a leftist billionaire? Do they come out that way, or do they look at or maybe is it a disruptive force? The whole idea is to break down and just break down any tradition.
Yeah, there was a left-wing activist all the way back in the 60s who had a great, a very honest line. The issue is never the issue. Mm-hmm. The issue is always the revolution. So tearing down anything connected to the American founding, the traditions of American society, or at this point, even just sanity. I mean, look at the Soros DAs, for God's sake.
All right, so that was the author, Scott Walter, on a show called The Bill Maher Show out in Oregon. So I'm going to go to you first, Gary. You know what's interesting is we know all of this. The New York Post is showing how, again, Soros is causing trouble. It's expanding, obviously, law enforcement resources out there. But it's really, like they said, anything that is bad for America, these guys are behind. And is there no law? I guess I'm just thinking out loud. Is there no law that can do something against this, folks? Or what do you make of all this that we just talked about here?
Well, in that tape that you just played, Paul, what really jumped out at me was the statement that the issue is never the issue.
Yeah.
The issue is the revolution. Because if you don't understand that, this does not make sense, does it? Why spend all this money for destruction? Why spend all this money to topple our civilization? Unless the purpose is to build upon the ruins, the smoldering ruins of that civilization, the New World Order, that these billionaires are working to bring about. And of course, they imagine themselves to be the rulers of the world when this New World Order is fully implemented.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Steve? What do you think of all this?
Well, you know, as you're going over, I was running through my mind this idea that a lot of people have on the so-called right, that which I think, you know, Ayn Rand and her epigones were responsible perhaps for popularizing, and this is that very wealthy, successful men who have risen up, you know, become billionaires or
capitalists.
Are capitalist heroes. Yeah. And given their druthers, that they would tear down all of the unjust portions of government, you know, all the, you know, all the regulators and all the controls that are keeping down the, you know, the, and that they would be champions of the free market. When in fact, as perhaps sober minds like Murray Rothbard and others pointed out, you know, history shows this is not the case. There are some people, you know, very successful entrepreneurial capitalists who rise up, become billionaires, and stay true to the principles that enabled their success. Okay, but there are a significant number as well who, once they, you know, rise to dizzying heights, get seduced by by the power, by the success, by the desire to retain their position, to fight off competitors and everything else, and in effect join the enemy camp. So, for example, the original Rockefeller is a really good instance of this. So Rockefeller was...
Old John D?
Yeah, John D, the original guy, you know, he was quite the heroic innovator. At least he started out that way. Amazing guy.
Yeah.
Incredibly hardworking.
His dad was a con man.
A visionary. You know, he achieved all these amazing things, but he got to a certain point, he became the establishment.
Yeah.
You know, his scions and descendants ever since, the Rockefeller dynasty has been one of the major groups of left-wing billionaire interests in the United States,
they're
globalists
very much,
and everything else.
Yeah, they're very much involved here.
So this is an unfortunate byproduct of the free market system, is that it is often is a victim of its own success, that it creates people that, you know, to become multi-skillionaires. I mean, a lot of these tech billionaires like Bill Gates and so forth probably started out being fairly libertarian or something like that, because they literally started in the garage.
Yeah.
Classic rags to riches story of some extraordinary people. And then at a certain point they decide, but now that we've arrived, we don't want our success being jeopardized by new entrants to the industry. So they begin to forge relationships with the government to cement their position. And then from there, they become more and more sympathetic with all these other causes that are espoused by the political elites.
Yeah.
And then you have this weird situation, this seemingly paradoxical situation of these people who have benefited so much from capitalism becoming its most potent foes.
But how much, Steve, do you think of that transformation that you're talking about is a result of what we call capitalism? Because there are free enterprise capitalists, and there are also monopolistic capitalists. And, of course, what you're describing are the people who become monopolistic capitalists.
Yeah.
They don't want other people to achieve the success that they did through free enterprise capitalism. But could they have become monopolists in the first place without the intervention of government that they helped bring about?
Let me
get
in here, because I want to throw something on top of that, and then Steve can answer. Is these people, my understanding is a lot of these folks, once they get really rich and they get very powerful and they start rubbing shoulders with the most influential and powerful people around the world, they start to get into this mindset that there's more to life, more to their lives anyway, than just accruing money. So they start getting these ideas about building utopias. And I think that plays into this.
Well, it's part of it. I mean, you know, when you, again, if you are successful enough to amass billions of dollars, first of all, you want to keep those billions, and being aware yourself that you started out as the little guy and worked yourself up, you know that there are other people, what would be entrants out there that would like to knock you off your pedestal, or whose success indirectly perhaps jeopardizes your own. So, I mean, you know, but I think it really goes down, you know, to Gary's point. I think it goes down to something that is a, you know, probably part of our flawed, mortal, fallible DNA, which is pride and greed and all these other things. Paradoxically, the so-called greedy capitalists that the left loves to caricature are in fact people generally who started out as successful entrepreneurs who then forged a relationship with political power to cement those gains, to keep them in place, and in effect to cartelize whatever, you know, sector, you know, whether it's high tech or railroads going back to the 19th century, you know, the robber barons and all that. You know, some of them were, in fact, you know, men who became very much, you know, cheek and jowl with interests in Washington, D.C. And but of course, they're accused of gotten, you know, their ill-gotten gains supposedly were because of the market system, and not because having taken, you know, the market system to their advantage, a good thing, you know, created an enormous amount of wealth, also a good thing. They then went on to say, okay, now we're going to forge a relationship, a permanent relationship with the state, to make sure that nothing ever changes, to make sure that we and our descendants, you know, keep this money, this power in perpetuum.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I wanted to show one last thing from this organization, because this shows exactly that. They use this nonprofit, and the author there mentioned that one of the things they're attacking is Title IX. Title IX, of course, is the education law that was passed to protect women and women's sports on college campuses. But they're trying to change Title IX, to change the rules for instance, investigations of sexual assault allegations in ways that seriously weaken the due process rights of accused young men. We always see that. There's lots of efforts on that. And it would also require schools, colleges, and universities to allow men and boys to compete in women's girls in women's sports. And so the president of the Defense of Freedom Institute called this all this what they're trying to do, what these billionaires are trying to do through these nonprofits. It says, by commandeering Title IX, progressives seek to force all educational institutions that receive federal funds to heed to their ideological agendas on issues of gender identity, family, free speech, religious liberty, and abortion. They're obviously trying to change the culture, the entire culture. All right, so we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to be looking at what has been going on in the Trump saga over the last week. We'll be right back.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
All right, and we're back. Well, Gary, like I said last segment, it's been almost an entire week. This is what you get for leaving. since we reported on something Trump related. Now, the hot item has been regarding this immunity claim. So take it away, Gary. Fill us in. What's been going on? You and Steve, bounce back here. Let us know what's going on in the Trump saga.
Well, before we get to presidential immunity, because there's been a lot happening with the weaponization of the law to go after Trump, I'd like to start with a clip from the professor, Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, the leftist, right. Professor.
The
right?
Leftist professor, somebody who is, I believe, a sincere liberal, because he honestly believes in civil rights.
Okay.
And in this clip, he is talking about what is happening in Manhattan. So let's go to the clip.
There is no crime in Manhattan. You cannot figure out what the crime is. That's why they're putting on all this evidence of non-crimes, trying to persuade the jury that catch and kill is a crime. It's not. Paying hush money is a crime. It's not. Putting a corporate statement is a misdemeanor barred by the statute of limitations. You can't suddenly resurrect that and turn that into a crime by invoking a federal statute, which the federal government refused to invoke, yeah, and the Federal Election Commission refused to invoke. There is no crime. Wow. And if it's Donald Trump, they can go after you tomorrow and your relatives tomorrow for something that isn't a crime. That's why every American, whether you're a Democrat, should be opposed to what's going on in that Manhattan courtroom. It's a scandal, and it's a destruction of America's rule of law.
Well, he pulled no punches.
He sure did not. Of course, the jury, I think it's fair to say, in Manhattan is a biased jury. So, you know, the fact that this is so crazy, this weaponization of the law, does not necessarily mean that Trump is going to become, well, that he will be found not guilty. But you know, in a sane world, or in a world where you actually had the media, the major media, reporting honestly, this whole thing is a kangaroo court. It's just an absolute joke. It's a show trial along the lines that we would expect to see in Stalinist Russia.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to note that the other day, while I was out of the country, it turns out that the state Supreme Court in New York vacated or got threw out one of the convictions
of Weinstein,
of Harvey Weinstein. And the reason that was cited,
that
of course,
is interesting,
was that the whole nature of the trial and the evidence was what they call corroborative evidence, which is a big no-no in law, where you simply come in, like, let's say, you know, Paul Dragoo is accused of, oh, I don't know, robbing a bank, okay? And they come in, and as evidence, they talk all about the fact that, well, you know, Paul Dragoo, when he was 15 years old, was caught shoplifting. And Paul Dragoo, when he was 17 years old, did this. And also, he's a mean guy. And here's some friends that can tell you what a nasty guy he was and how he always, and all. So this is basically an attempt to establish guilt by painting you as a bad person.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is apparently, they did a lot of this with the Weinstein trial back, what, 5-6 years ago, whenever that was. With a lot of people coming in and said, oh, yeah, Harvey Weinstein, you know, he also propositioned me or did all these other unseemly things.
Because he's a scumbag.
Which technically didn't have any bearing on, you know, the facts of what he was accused of. Well, they're doing precisely the same thing with Trump in the trial in Manhattan. They're bringing, was it the National Enquirer? I think it is now.
Is that
and
source?
Things like this.
What a reliable source.
Yeah, and this kind of thing. So
that's awesome.
So on the one hand, you say, well, obviously, this is ultimately all going to get thrown out. The problem is, it probably won't get thrown out until after the election. So there's a very strong likelihood that, in fact, these crooked scumbags are going to put Trump in jail. They're going to get a conviction on one or more things, and they're going to, of course, go for the jugular. And he is, as I've been predicting all along, probably going to wind up doing time in jail.
Yeah.
And that may or may not affect the outcome of the elections this fall if he's sitting in jail under these spurious charges. While, of course, I mean, the system has been moving like quicksilver rapidity to get the trials going, get the convictions going. Once the appeals process starts, of course, it's going to slow down to the typical magisterial, slow, deliberative pace of the law to drag this out as long as possible.
I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, Steve, that Trump is going to end up in jail. But at the same time, if I had a lot of money, I would not bet against you.
Oh, come on. With the Manhattan jury, with the judges and the corrupt prosecutors involved? I mean, we don't have time to go into all the details.
The thing is, it's just so transparent. That there's nothing to this case.
To us, it's transparent to them also.
But they
believe that Trump is the devil incarnate, and therefore the ends justify the means.
Let's hope there's at least one principal liberal in that jury who does not believe that the ends justify the means.
That's all it takes. Yeah. Yep. I'm going to side with Gary. I think that's where you are. I think Steve's going to these.
We'll revisit this in a few months.
Yeah, we will. What about immunity? What's all this talk about immunity? Is that a different case?
Well, I'd like to go to another clip, and this one is with U.S. Supreme Court Justice Kagan.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asking hypothetical questions at the Trump attorney. And let's take a look at that clip and because these questions are incredible and see how they were answered.
Okay.
If a president sells nuclear secrets to a foreign adversary, is that immune?
That sounds like, similar to the bribery example, likely not immune. Now, if it's structured as an official act, he would have to be impeached and convicted first before.
What does that mean if it's structured as an official act?
Well, I don't know in the hypothetical whether or not that would be an official act. You'd probably have to have more details to apply the Blazing Game analysis or even the Fitzgerald analysis that we've been talking about.
How about if a president orders the military to stage a coup?
I think that, as the Chief Justice pointed out earlier, where there is a whole series of, you know, sort of guidelines against that, so to speak, like the UCMJ prohibits the military from following a plainly unlawful act. If one adopted Justice Alito's test, that would fall outside. Now, if one adopts, for example, the Fitzgerald test that we advanced, that might well be an official act, and he would have to be, as I'll say in response to all these kinds of hypotheticals, has to be impeached and convicted before he can be criminally prosecuted.
Right. That whole crazy notion, like you have to be convicted. I think they've lost.
Well, certainly the media lost that perspective, didn't they? Because the way the media is portraying what the Trump team is saying is that what they're saying is the president can do
whatever he wants.
Whatever he wants, period.
Stage a coup.
No worries. As long as he does it as president,
yeah.
As long as he claims that it's part of his official duties, there is no way on earth under any circumstances. They're claiming the Trump's team is
this
saying
whole case is about
that this could
right?
be criminally prosecuted. And that's not what they're saying. You know, it was very clear what was said by the Trump attorney, D. John Sawyer,
yeah,
is that the Congress, well, specifically the House of Representatives, would have to impeach the president mm-hmm. for his high crimes and misdemeanors, and then the president would have to be convicted by the Senate.
Yeah.
And then after that, it could go into a civil court.
Yeah.
And the civil court could punish them with jail term or whatever the appropriate punishment right. is. But you don't get that through the filter of the media, do you?
No. Steve?
Well, I mean, you know, the delicious irony.
irony.
Well, both of the for instances that were set forth by Justice Kagan have already happened, okay? Lest we forget, Bill Clinton did in fact authorize the transfer of U.S. nuclear technology, specifically ICBM technology, to the People's Republic of China. And the original drive to impeach Bill Clinton was motivated only in part by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. There were other articles of impeachment that were ultimately dismissed because it was considered to be just too much for people to imagine, that showed very clearly that with the help of the Riady family, a Chinese-Indonesian, you know, family and others' connections, that Bill Clinton, in exchange for generous amounts of campaign, you know, re-election campaign contributions, quietly authorized L'Oreal Corporation to transfer gimbal technology to the Chinese. And the result was, within a few years, the Chinese had missiles, nuclear mm-hmm. missiles, that could reach the United States. That happened on Bill Clinton's watch. He was not impeached for it. Okay, yeah. And let's see, the other one they mentioned was, Bill Clinton also deposed the president of Haiti. He authorized an invasion of Haiti, deposed Raoul, what's his name, and made sure that Jean-Baptiste Aristide, an absolute Marxist nutcase,
yeah.
was installed well, as the leader. But... So he's done both of those things, and he's never seen any court time for that.
But isn't
so,
she talking
come
about,
on, people.
Yeah. Isn't she talking about staging a coup against the government here, like within the government Not, here?
Well, yes. I don't know.
I assume that's, that well, was that's what I how I interpreted it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose against the government here would be a different thing. But even in right. that case, one wonders.
But January 6th was portrayed by the major media as being an insurrection. And of course it was not, but it was portrayed that way. So you could say, well, according to the media, that was an attempted coup. But the thing is,
right, that's
although
that's part of the narrative they're trying to.
Although, ridiculously, Trump was impeached for that by the House, the Senate did not convict him.
Yeah, and you know, some arguments that I listened to. One of the lawyers that's arguing on what's his name, Jack, the main prosecutor,
Jack Smith.
That's why I thought mm-hmm. it was Smith. Okay,
yeah.
So Jack Smith on his side was saying to the justice, I think it was to Clarence Thomas. It was back and forth mm-hmm. there, and. He was saying, in effect, well, what we need to do, because he said, well, the thing is, impeachment has never worked. He said this. He said, we've never been actually removed anyone from office because of an impeachment. So therefore, we need to going forward, have a standard where the Department of Justice and other mm-hmm. relevant legal authorities, prosecutors and so forth, should be able to selectively go after criminal behavior mm. on the part of the president, because clearly impeachment is an insufficient mm. remedy.
Right. I wonder if that means okay, turning it over to the experts.
So in other words, give us that power going mm-hmm. forward, and we'll be judicious. We'll be careful with it.
Okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but here's yep. the reality. Probably a majority of U.S. presidents, we talked about Bill Clinton just now, but we could deduce many other names, both Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. have been guilty of conduct that under other circumstances would probably be criminal. So, for example, President Obama droning American citizens in the Middle East and all kinds of other things,
yeah.
all kinds of other unseemly conduct. But the problem is, and the perspective of the founders seems very clear, is that if you simply allow the president and other key people in government, like Supreme Court justices, to be open to legal action at the discretion of the court system, at the discretion of private litigants yeah. or whatever it happens to be, then there'll be no end to this, okay? And if this procedure
well,
goes
then
there'll
be what we're seeing now.
If they're successful in establishing this new precedent, then expect to see some, because there are no statute of limitations on things like assassination and murder, mm-hmm. well, let's go after Barack Obama, let's go after George W. Bush for all the things, I mean, they're still alive. The Clintons, all this type of thing. And while that may seem palatable to those of us who found their yeah. policies at the time objectionable, the broader context is that it will truly transform this country into a banana republic where the president can be literally deposed by judicial action at any time.
Yeah.
And the process of impeachment will then become nothing more than a historical curiosity.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say, though, in fact, I would argue unequivocally that past presidents have committed horrendous crimes.
Sure.
How do you get around that? One thought would be Pearl Harbor. The fact that the administration, the Roosevelt administration, knew that the attack was coming, that Pearl Harbor was set up.
Avoided it.
And use that as a rationale when the attack occurred to get us into World War II, and did not inform the commanders in Pearl Harbor what was coming. And we could go through a whole litany. So, you know, the question is, are there things that are so horrendous
that's a good question.
A president should be held accountable for his crimes? And I would say yes, but and this is really a question for you, Steve, because I don't understand this as well as I should, but the impeachment process that we have, let's say FDR was impeached for his crimes and convicted by the Senate. Could at that point that have gone to a civil court?
Well, once he's removed from office, of course. Yes. That's the whole point, is right. that you because as provided for by the Constitution, impeachment can only be for removal from office. Okay, that's right. all. And that's why the second impeachment of Donald Trump was completely illegitimate, because he'd already left office. It's absolutely, you know, nugatory to impeach someone who's no longer in office.
It's a backdated impeachment.
Right? Okay, so...
retroactive impeachment.
Right, but here's the thing. I mean, impeachment, along with many other of the instruments of, you know, the checks and balances in our system, require a high degree of moral fortitude to work properly. And while it may be viscerally appealing to say, they need to get their just deserts... Yeah. You know, by hook or that, well, that's essentially the same as saying, okay, well, we see the fact that our country's falling apart right now. So do we march on Washington, stage a revolution, hang them all from lampposts? Or do we say, okay, you know, viscerally appealing as that might seem to some of us, do we go through the process of persuading and educating people, or in this case, re-educating perhaps, so that they will begin to vote and get the right people into office, a process that we may not live to see the full consummation of. It may take decades and decades to go that way,
right,
as opposed to the violent revolutionary overthrow. And let's, you know, kind of like in that movie Civil War that came out the other week that a couple of us went to see.
Right.
You know, that's why people resort to that. That's a shortcut that people say, okay, it's come to this point. This is how we have to solve the problem. Well, impeachment's the same way. Impeachments have been relatively infrequent until recent history in our country. And we've never removed any public official by impeachment, including a president. So that's frustrating to people who would like to see justice done. The same is true of our justice system writ large. Some of the most hardened criminals literally get away with murder, as the recently late O.J. Simpson showed us all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, but this is what happens. This is the price you pay for having a free society.
So what's next on the docket here? What are we expecting this week? Who knows? What's on Trump's docket? What are we looking for as far as any developments? We have
I don't have a crystal ball, but I think it's fair to say that this weaponization of the law is going to continue.
And, so is he in two different courts? Is he in court for the hush money in Manhattan? And is he also in the classified documents? Is that all happening at the same time?
No. That's before
the Supreme Court. The classified documents one is before the Supreme Court. That's the immunity case.
Well, that's still in the pretrial phase.
Yeah, and that's being argued by the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then we have Manhattan. All right. Thanks, guys. We're going to keep an eye on this. And now that we got Steve back from around the world, we're going to have more details on it. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about what Jack Posobiec told a New American over the weekend.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
And we're back, folks. So over the weekend, Bucharest, Romania hosted the Make Europe Great Again conference. Now, the New American, along with other very credible alternative news sources, attended. We have lots of footage, and you should go to thenewamerican.com to watch a lot of it. But we're going to play an interview that we did that Veronica Karolinko, who's a senior editor here, she conducted an interview with Jack Posobiec, who is the host of the popular podcast Human Events, and he's a former naval intelligence officer. So we're going to play this interview, and then we're going to come back after the break to discuss some of the points that Jack made. We'll be right back.
Jack, you just came back from CPAC Hungary, and you spoke there, and you said that Western civilization was the greatest achievement in the human history. Would you elaborate on that? That's such a strong statement.
Well, I think it's a true statement. I mean, you look at the vast majority of technology that we live with that built the modern world. You look at the countries that gave us the Industrial Revolution. You look at the countries that gave us the space race. Of course, you also look at the countries that spread Christianity throughout the world. And it always goes back to Western civilization. The reason that we have the modern society that we do today is because of Western civilization. The reason that we have the ideals we do today is because of Western civilization, of course, infused with Christian morals. And this is where we get the law of Rome, the philosophy of Greece. These are the ideas that have led in the entire concept of human rights and human flourishing around the world. And it's all because of Western civilization. And so when people want to, it's very popular now to attack Western civilization and to tear down Western civilization, decry Western civilization as colonizers and exploiters and invaders and all of these things, these terrible things. And they never once stop and credit Western civilization with the achievements that it has accomplished throughout the past 2,000 years. And so for me to say something like that is, you know, of course it's a bold statement, and it's also a true statement, but it's interesting because in the West is the only place you would ever find anyone who disagrees that their civilization is the best. If you go to a Chinese person, a Chinaman, and you say, what is the greatest civilization? Of course they will say China. If you go to a Japanese, you'll say, what's the best civilization? They will say Japan. If you go to someone from India, what's the best civilization? They'll say India. It is only in Western civilization. If you ask a Westerner, what's the best civilization? They will say something like, oh, all cultures are equal, or we should all get along and be friends. And it's amazing to me that Westerners have this pathology. It's actually a pathology. It's a form of mental sickness.
But not all Westerners, obviously. Some of them would be very proud of their civilization, right? So how do you explain that some of the Westerners would be ashamed of being Westerners?
Well, this is what we call liberalism. This is what we call leftism, cultural Marxism. Take your pick. They're all flavors of the exact same cornucopia of mental poison and toxic ideas that have come up in the last 200, 250 years since the French Revolution. And these are false ideals and false beliefs that really... what it is it's not rooted, they will tell you it's rooted in equality. They say everyone, it should be better if everyone were equal, and it would be better if everyone were the same, and it would be better if everyone could share and all these things. And it sounds nice and it sounds delightful if it were true. And of course it can't be true. And what it actually though is rooted in, it's rooted in jealousy, it's rooted in cruelty, it's rooted in specifically in envy. And because of these angry beliefs, this is why, and you could see it, go meet some liberal. They're always the most unhappy people that you'll ever find. They're always upset about something new. They're always looking for something to be outraged about. Oh, good morning, what are we outraged about today? I mean, imagine living your life like that. And so what they actually seek to do is they see the great accomplishments of the great cities of the West, the technology of the West, the countries and nations of the greatest nations on the face of the earth, the nations that people want to come into so much that they will break the law and crawl across miles of desert to get into because these nations are so great. I said, I'm not the one who's saying that the nations are the greatest. Just look at the behavior of the people of the world, and you must conclude that these are the greatest nations in the world. And so for the people inside those nations to actually believe this, it is a very, very bad case of mental delusion.
What do you see as the biggest challenges facing Western civilization, both externally and internally?
Well, of course, right now it's the collapse of spirituality, particularly in Christianity, because Christians allowed themselves more so in Western Christianity than Eastern Christianity. So, in my talking about this, when Eastern Christianity and the Orthodox world, they don't have this problem as much. But in Western Christianity, they became soft and they became weak and they allowed themselves to be pushed to the furthest margins of society, where they now think that Christian belief just means, oh, well, I will go to church on Sunday and say some prayers, do this, and I go home and that's it. And they stopped actually practicing their faith or bringing their faith and values, specifically the moral system, into society. And so because of this, society has degenerated and broken apart along secular lines. And so secularism has led to a spiritual death of the West. And because of the spiritual death of the West and a rise in materialism, this is where we get conflict. This is where we get internal strife. This is where we get racial, ethnic, gender, all of these tensions that are going on because we have a complete collapse in spirituality.
This is one internal threat. What are the external threats?
Well, I do think the internal threat is the greatest threat currently, because if we fix the internal threat, we can actually solve all of the external threats. Externally, it's very clear. In the United States has more of an issue with this than Europe. We are being invaded. We are being invaded every single day by thousands and thousands of third world people across our southern border, and they're not even from Mexico. In many cases, they're Indios from Central America, from South America, and in some cases, you're getting people from all over the world, people from Africa, people from China. No serious country would allow something like this to happen, and this pushes pressure on our wages. It puts pressure on inflation. It puts pressure on housing, healthcare, education. Every single industry in America is affected by this invasion, and yet we are told that for us to talk about it makes us some kind of, they'll put some label on you if you even talk about the fact that it's happening. So this really is an external threat that threatens to completely unravel our entire nation.
Yeah, and Jack, one more thing. You mentioned colonialism, but I want to ask you this because, well, you see all great civilizations manifest themselves as empires, and Western empires, well, historically they tended to go to war, they tended to colonize other territories, and I mean, it wasn't always very pretty because it was forceful. Do we think we need to overcome our desire to conquer for the self-preservation, because historically empires fall as a result of overstretching?
Well, all empires go through various cycles, but at the same time, if you reorder your whole society around defense, around preservation, around safety, around caution, then you will never attempt to achieve anything. I will be safe if I stay home and sit on my couch and don't do anything ever, but then what can you achieve if you don't go out? I'm a Navy officer, and they say, no ship was made to stay in the harbor where it is safe. And so as a civilization, you must grow and you must progress. What I mainly think about right now is space exploration and how the countries of the world, particularly in the West, with the exception of Elon Musk, I think he's the only one who's actually still trying to go to space, but everybody else is so concerned with the petty tensions of life on Earth and solving or going back to conflicts from hundreds of years ago that they would rather than actually progressing humanity itself. And so, yes, you're right. Human nature is inevitable. Human nature is not able to be changed. This is a key difference, by the way, in thinking between conservatives and progressives. Progressives believe you can actually change human nature, whereas conservatives believe that human nature is, by its inherent value, always going to be fallen, is always going to be corruptible. It's going to be, as a Catholic, we would say, you have original sin. And because of original sin, we have a tendency to sin. This theologically comes from the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and the fall of the garden. And so the reason that we have this human nature is because of our sinful nature. And sinful nature cannot be changed. And it's because of sinful nature that you get warfare, conflict, imperial conquest, all of these things. And so can it be avoided? Sure. And we should always strive to avoid war when possible, but we should also be cognizant of the fact that it is always going to be in our nature. And at the same time, I would say, I would very, very much stress that we cannot allow our societies to be centered around the idea of caution and safety, because it will prevent growth and will prevent innovation and will prevent real progress from ever happening.
What do you see as the best ways to preserving Western civilization?
Well, I think that from a legal standpoint, we need to roll back so many of the changes that have been made to our laws, going back 50 years or more in some cases, restoring actual human rights to people when it comes to property, when it comes to freedom of association, when it comes to the preservation of life. Of course, I'm extremely pro-life, Catholic, again, this is pretty much how we come. And mainly though, restoring the quality of life of the basic citizen must be first. And I think I'm critical of conservatives because conservatives have a tendency to put the interests of business and the interests of economics first and foremost. And the interests of a multinational corporation may not be the same as the interests of the average person or the average family. And so you mentioned we were in Hungary. And so something that Viktor Orban has done that I think we can learn a lot from is he is changed his way of thinking. And in Hungary, they don't talk about the country as a business unit. They talk about the country as a family. And if Hungarians can be a family, if Americans could be a family, then you change your priorities in terms of governance.
I'm sorry, how can we be family with liberals whom you just described as practically mentally ill? How do we bridge divides with these people?
Well, what I'm saying is, when I say I want to think of Americans as a family, I'm saying that if I want a good economy, I want a good economy for everybody. If I want a safe country, I want a safe country for everybody. The vision that we are talking about, so liberals are very good at presenting their vision of utopia and equality and everything is perfect. And it's ridiculous, but it's a strong message that they sell. And I'll give them credit for that. But when I talk about a good society, when I talk about a society that we're trying to put together, and this is something conservatives are terrible at explaining, because they will argue all the time, I'm talking about a city that has businesses in it that are operating at full capacity, that are conducting trade potentially with other countries. You have ports with ships that are going in and out to other countries, conducting trade with good policies where our country is benefiting economically. Our country is not at a disadvantage like we are currently with China. I mean, a place where you can walk down a city street with your family and your children, go visit a park and not have to worry about drugs or violent criminals or some insane person coming up and running after you. This is what we're talking about in terms of treating your country like a family, providing for the basic qualities of life that everyone would benefit from. And so even if the liberals would benefit, yes, I will benefit the liberals too.
Sounds good. That was Jack Posobiec. Everyone, Jack, would you please tell us how can we follow you and learn more about your work?
Yeah, go to humanevents.com is the website, and at Jack Posobiec on X and all the other social medias.
All right, guys. So there were quite a few things in that interview that Jack Posobiec mentioned, and I'm going to focus on one, and maybe you guys could focus on the other. When he was asked what the biggest challenge to Western civilization was, he said the fall of or the attack on Christianity, or the crumbling, the atrophying Christianity. And that really speaks to me, as not only because I'm a Christian, but because we all know that the foundation of Western civilization, of Christendom, which, by the way, Steve did a terrific article on months ago. I still think about that one, Steve. But is that Christian, those Christian morals. And you can look from even from science. You have Copernicus and you have Galileo and Kepler. And, you know, they were able to become great scientists because they knew that there was, you know, they were interested in the cosmos and they had this awe. And this awe comes from those, from this fascination, and it's called awe with God, when you realize that God exists and whatnot. So that awe has created, I think, a lot of the innovation and whatnot. But also, it allows us not to have all these rules and laws, right? Who was it? Was it John Adams or who said that the Constitution is made only for a moral people? One of those guys.
John Adams.
So that's really what stuck out with me, because I think this is something. And then he said that, talked about how people need to stop being shy about bringing their spiritual convictions into the public square. I don't think he means like we need to preach out there, because I'm not necessarily against, you know, I'm not going to go out there with signs, and I'm not going to make you guys. We're all actually very different denominations. And, you know, I wouldn't.
Paul, can I ask a rhetorical question of you and of all of our viewers and listeners? When was the last time you heard church bells?
Oh, I hear them. I live in a small town.
Well, when I was a kid,
I heard it yesterday.
It's a really good question.
Well, when I was a kid, it was a commonplace, and the small town that I grew up near in Pennsylvania used to be. There's actually the dominant church. There is a Catholic church, a big Catholic church in the hill, and they would run the bells every noon, and in the evening. For like 15-minute bell concerts. They had a carol on there. And then the other churches, you know, some of the different Protestant churches would also have their bells that would toll the hour. And in recent years, those bells have all fallen silent. Mm. And I'm given to understand that the reason is that many people who aren't Christian complain that they're disruptive and people don't want to hear it anymore.
Oh.
And so that's just one example of many that we could adduce. I just got back from nearly a week in a proud Islamic country, okay? And I will say this. You enter this country and you've no doubt that you've entered an part of the Islamic world. I mean, you see mosques and minarets everywhere. You see signs of their form of devotion everywhere.
And you hear the prayers.
You hear the muezzins calling to prayer. At one point, I was standing on the riverbank in the evening, and there were like 20 mosques within ear range, and they all start at the same time. There's just booming voices everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, take that for what it is, but the fact is, when you get outside of the Western world, be it the Islamic world or the Buddhist world or whatever, you arrive in these places and you say, okay, yeah, there's no doubt that
that's what's the main
that's the animating force. Yep. The word culture comes from the word religion. No civilization yet has ever arisen without there being an antecedent culture.
Yeah.
And Western civilization's culture is Christian in the same way that Islamic civilization's culture is based on Islam and Hindu civilization's culture is based on Hinduism.
Okay? Yeah.
Because religion is how we capture or conceptualize the most important ideas.
It is. That's,
you know,
the filter.
How we connect this world with the next. Okay.
Yeah.
And so everything that comes out, you know, our form of government, our sciences, our art,
it all
everything comes out of that. When you take away that, when you yank out that underpinning, that religious underpinning, there's nothing left.
Well, that's the revolution they're trying to throw in there. Now, speaking of Western civilization, what did you think about his comments where, this really resonated too, where he said, we seem to be the only civilization, and I would say we have the most to be proud of, who don't think that we're the best civilization. Right. You know, he mentioned the Chinese. You lived in China, and I'm sure that's part of being whatever you are. I don't think it's not racist or anything like that. Although it seems like that's what they're injecting into the culture. Well, if you think Western civilization is the best, you're racist. That's nonsense.
Here's the thing, Paul.
It is the
best. To build a civilization requires a considerable amount of sacrifice. It requires people doing things above and beyond merely, you know, scraping by to survive. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, it has to have a sustaining vision, in other words. And that vision cannot come from anywhere in the long run than from religion.
Yeah.
In the case of the West, from Christianity. The people who built those magnificent cathedrals in the High Middle Ages, all the great scientists, Newton and all these people, Leibniz, they all conceived of what they were doing for the greater glory of God. They didn't have to do that.
Right.
You know, those people who spent generations building those great cathedrals and making those great advances in architecture and art in the process could have done other things, maybe made more money or done whatever, but they didn't, you know. And
they had a higher calling.
And that state of affairs, that mindset has persisted in the West into the 20th century. And then
now they're trying to kill it.
Now they're trying to kill it. I mean, there's sort of this weird rump civilization that is running on the fumes of the Western civilization, where we still purport to respect individual liberty, you know, the quest for scientific knowledge and all of this. But now that we've subtracted God from that, the energy is gone. the sense of kind of cultural chutzpah, so to speak, is gone. There's this idea that we're just sort of a felicitous arrangement of governments and
we're
laws and people, and,
and
there's nothing more than that. You were all hollowed out.
Yeah.
You know, communism is the only culture that started on a purely secular basis, and it really didn't last very long.
No, no, and it's always always trying to resurrect it. All right, Gary, we're going to let you take us home here.
I'm going to take us home by saying something positive, because it can sound pretty negative.
No!
Because we're witnessing.
This is why we have Gary here.
The decline, or you could even say the death of Western culture, of Western civilization, of Christianity. But the thing is, it has not been totally eradicated. There's still millions of people who do believe in these great virtues of the past. There are millions of people who are committed Christians, committed Jews, who. Unlike many modern day Jews, there are other Jews today who really believe in their own religion.
I would say it's at least half, if not a slim majority.
So really, all that is necessary is to reclaim what we've had in the past, to go back to the past, go back to these great virtues, go back to the great principles that made our civilization so great. And to reclaim those principles.
Well, and to reclaim those, though, we have to engage with the God that's calling us. Man, this is turning like an evangelical show, but we have to realize that, like Steve had helped build a case here, and that this is the foundation of our society. We have to bring this back up. We have to acknowledge our Christian findings, our Christian influences, and we have to do so even publicly where appropriate.
Exactly, because we have been conditioned, we have been indoctrinated as a people to actually feel ashamed about our own culture.
I believe you're right. Yeah, they do that.
To feel ashamed if we're Christians. To look at the world as if it doesn't make any difference what culture you belong to.
Or that you give
And obviously it does make a difference. We don't want to go to the Aztec culture of murdering on their altars tens and tens and hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
So we should feel proud of the heritage that we've inherited.
The thing
and
is
we should shout it from the housetops.
The thing is, it's easy to feel ashamed if you no longer believe in Christianity. That's the problem.
And let's think about where the church started. It was people, you read the New Testament and Paul says it over and over. I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is for the power unto God. And so it's like those guys knew out of all what it's like to live in an oppressive, persecutorial society. And out of those ashes, out of the ashes of the Roman Empire, which collapsed, came the Christian church.
And that should give us hope as well, because who could have imagined that at the time, except maybe the Christians themselves.
Except for God, who planned it.
That's right.
Well, no, I mean, it may sound like we're not hopeless here, because I think we can all agree. We know, we can see history. Steve and you guys, you're more studiers of history. And we know that all the attempts against Christianity have failed. And we know that they will all fail in the long run. Thank you, gentlemen. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of the New American Daily. Remember to visit newamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And please join us again tomorrow.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.